Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today we'll be reading from Volume 62, Number 2, the Spring 2023 issue, produced by the North Carolina Museum of History, Legacies of Reconstruction, North Carolina After Emancipation. And we'll begin with the article on the inside front cover from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Association Program Coordinator. Hey, y'all. When you first picked up this magazine, did you know what was meant by the word reconstruction in the title? We're not talking about building construction. We cover that in the Fall 2020 issue. We're talking about reconstructing or rebuilding a society and our nation in the years after the American Civil War. What a big and important task. How could the government bring the southern states back into the Union and establish and protect the citizenship rights of the formerly enslaved population? This was a time of hope and opportunity, but also a time of confusion and pushback. Maybe it is the challenge of recognizing both the hope and opportunity and the purposeful dismantling of Reconstruction that causes some adults, even historians and teachers, to glide over these years. But all history, even if it's confusing or disappointing, affects our world, your world, today. Understanding that history helps us make choices every day. Plus, we want to share the many meaningful and inspiring stories of people from North Carolina during Reconstruction. I was a junior and a history major in college when I first heard about the Wilmington Coup of 1898, an event that impacted not just lives in the Wilmington area, but also state and national politics and history for years to come. But you won't have to wait that long to learn about the staggering event in our state and what led to it. Just a few more pages. Jessica Pratt. There's a photograph of Jessica, and the caption is, "In this photo, I'm on the steps of the North Carolina State Capitol, which you may have visited on a field trip to Raleigh." Continue reading to learn about some of the Reconstruction-era politicians who served in this building. What and when was Reconstruction? Reconstruction is the name given to the period following the end of the Civil War when southern states were placed under military rule. Re means to do again. Construct means to build or create. And shun, T-I-O-N, is a suffix meaning something, making something a thing or a noun. So our definition is Reconstruction, the act of building again. The rebuilding of Reconstruction following the American Civil War, 1861 to 1865, is an important chapter in the history of civil rights in the United States. Traditionally, we learn that Reconstruction began at the end of the war in 1865 and ended with the withdrawal of federal troops in the South as part of the Compromise of 1877. This compromise was an informal agreement that helped settle the 1876 presidential election. Southern Democrats agreed to drop their arguments against the election of Republican Rutherford B. Hayes in return for removal of federal troops from the southern states. That meant there were no federal troops there to enforce the political rights gained through the Reconstruction Amendments and revised state constitutions. So African American men began to lose those rights, leading to the loss of other civil and social rights for people of color. Now let's talk about why you'll see a few variations for those dates of the Reconstruction era in this issue. Today, many scholars and historians think the traditional dates of Reconstruction should extend to include other events that were part of rebuilding and its demise. Some suggest that Reconstruction really began in 1861, when the Union first captured territory in the Confederacy. Others believe that events occurring after 1877 marked important endings of Reconstruction policies. For example, when the Federal Elections Bill to secure black voting rights failed in 1890, or when, in 1896, The court case, Plessy v. Ferguson, declared racial segregation, which is the act of keeping people separate based on race, class, or ethnic group, to be legal. Many North Carolina historians argue that the Wilmington coup on November 10, 1898, was actually the true end of Reconstruction. One fact was clear. Following the November 1898 election, the Democratic Party regained full control of North Carolina government. The Democratic legislature cemented its control of government with a suffrage act in 1900. The act eliminated voting rights of almost every black man in the state for generations to come and forced people of color to find new ways forward in their efforts to gain social, legal, and civil equality. Remember, while the names of political parties may remain the same, their policies can change over time. And there's one photograph. The caption is, "This print by Thomas Kelly celebrates the passage of the 15th Amendment. The center image of a parade is surrounded by portraits and vignettes of black life that illustrate the rights granted by the amendment." The next article is the introduction to this issue, Legacies of Reconstruction, North Carolina After Emancipation, by LeRae Umfleet, who works for the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources and is the author of the book A Day of Blood, the 1898 Wilmington Race Riot, published by UNC Press in 2009. She has history degrees from UNC Chapel Hill and East Carolina University. Some say the story of Reconstruction is hard history. It's hard to keep all the dates and people and motives in order, even for historians. It's also hard to talk about. People did and said horrible things just because of race and power. Even though it's hard, it's still important to learn about Reconstruction and its effects. We need to talk through the emotions of learning about heavy topics. But we also know that the human spirit is resilient and that there's hope for the future. One of my favorite quotes is from an activist who pushed back against white supremacy rhetoric. White supremacy is the belief that white people are superior to other races and that white people should have control over people of other races. The quote is, "The destiny of a race is not in the keeping of one president or one party or one epoch of history. I have an abiding faith in the future." Timothy Thomas Fortune, a writer, journalist, and editor of the nation's leading black newspaper, the New York Age, to Booker T. Washington, December 17, 1898. Much of the push and pull of Reconstruction was connected to something very important, the work to reconnect the United States after a brutal and deadly Civil War. North Carolinians found themselves in a state torn apart by fire, disease, occupation by federal soldiers, and destruction everywhere. Rebuilding took place at the same time that the residents of the state were grappling with integrating newly freed black families into society, even as American Indians, who did not fit into the white or black categories of the narrative, tried to find their own path on the edge of the 20th century. For the newly freed African Americans, emancipation brought a life of hope mixed with uncertainty. Most owned no land, and many were separated from family and displaced from homes they knew before the war. Thousands migrated to other parts of the state to find work and stability in their freedom. These families created new communities in many regions of the state, including James City in Craven County and Princeville in Edgecombe County, but also in urban places like Wilmington, Raleigh, Durham, and Charlotte. At the same time, some white people sought to preserve the pre-war norms of white leadership and black subservience. Other white North Carolinians believed that only through the intervention of federal authorities, a political process that has become known as Reconstruction, would safety and equality for freed people be assured. But the Reconstruction era was not all about politics. The state sought advancements in education, transportation, industry, and agriculture, and North Carolina's economy grew beyond pre-war standards. Industry prospered through the growth of tobacco and textile products created in mills, paving the way for future growth. Fueling the development of the state into the 1880s was the expansion of railroads, connecting all parts of the state's backcountry with the coast and other states for trade and transportation. Historians typically say that Reconstruction in North Carolina began at the end of the Civil War and ended in 1877. Those 12 years were full of strife as politicians struggled to implement new laws and create a new state constitution designed to guarantee freedom and equality for about 350,000 African Americans in North Carolina. Reconstruction, as a long drawn out process, did not alleviate the troubles of rebuilding after the war as many hoped. Instead, it drew sharper definitions for many underlying problems facing North Carolina and the South. Questions arose as to the legal status of freed people. As a result, new black codes became a legal way for segregating and limiting black people in all parts of political, legal, and social life. In response, Congress passed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution, guaranteeing freedom, citizenship, and the right to vote for newly free, formerly enslaved men. However, as a student of the racially motivated violence in North Carolina that culminated in mass murder in Wilmington on November 10, 1898, I and many other historians argue that Reconstruction ended that day. Many African Americans across North Carolina, but particularly in Wilmington, had made gains in successfully participating across the political, economic, and social spectrum. However, all the achievements built up in the black community since emancipation came crashing down as the result of an 1898 white supremacy campaign and the subsequent massacre of innocent black people in Wilmington. The echoes of that violence sounded across the state and nation until the mid-20th century, when the brave men and women of the civil rights movement began to break the hold of Jim Crow and white supremacy. Jim Crow stands for laws put into place in the late 1800s and early 1900s to enforce segregation or separation of white, black, and American Indian people in public places. In the pages to come, you will read many stories about people who lived during these times. As we learn about Reconstruction, keep in mind that we must have an abiding faith in the future. Here are the captions with the accompanying photographs. A group portrait of the members of the North Carolina House of Representatives, including African Americans, who served during the 1874 to 1875 legislative session, taken at the state capitol in Raleigh. This illustration, titled The First Vote, appeared in the November 16, 1867 issue of Harper's Weekly. Black men of various occupations wait patiently for their turn to vote for the very first time. A laborer, a businessman, a Union soldier, and a farmer. This print shows a campaign banner for the 1864 Republican presidential candidate Abraham Lincoln and running mate Andrew Johnson, who was born in North Carolina. Lincoln won the election, but on April 14, 1865, Lincoln was assassinated, and Johnson became the president who would preside over Reconstruction. The next article is The First Weeks of Freedom, Emancipation at Stagville, by Vera Sieselski, the site manager for historic Stagville State Historic Site in Durham. In 1864, just before emancipation, the Cameron Plantation was one of the largest in all of North Carolina. A plantation is a large agricultural property that depends on the free labor of enslaved people. Today, part of this plantation is historic Stagville State Historic Site, a public site that you can visit to learn more about the history of slavery. At this plantation, the Cameron family enslaved more than 900 men, women, and children across 30,000 acres of land. For generations, enslaved people of African descent were held captive as human property there. These families lived with the constant dangers and threats of slavery. They were forced to work long days on farms and in shops and mills. Enslaved people could be brutally punished or killed for any attempt to resist or gain freedom. In April 1865, the Confederacy surrendered and emancipation was finally enforced. Emancipation is the freeing of a person from slavery. Emancipation was a time of hope and celebration for formerly enslaved people at Stagville. People shouted with joy, "We are free, free from slavery." But amid the joy, there was also fear and worry. Slavery had ended, but freed people at Stagville faced an uncertain future. Enslavers like the Camerons were already strategizing to recreate the injustices of slavery. At Stagville, freed people knew what they needed to make their freedom real: safety for their families, equal rights, fair work, an education, and a home. The struggle to secure these hoped-for freedoms began in 1865. In the first weeks of freedom, formerly enslaved people stayed at Stagville, but they refused to work for the Cameron family. For many, their first concern was safety and survival. Families had few resources and little protection after years of slavery. They took food and animals from the farms to eat and to trade for money to survive. They tried to protect themselves by driving the white overseers away. An overseer is a person in charge of running a property, such as a plantation, who supervises the work of others, especially laborers. They ordered overseers out of the fields or threatened to kill them. Some families may have stayed because they believed the plantation land should rightfully be theirs. After all, it was their enslavement and forced labor that had made the plantation so profitable. Paul Cameron, one of the plantation owners, complained that freed people had demands and exactions, expectations and hopes for land. When a federal officer visited Stagville, freedmen told him that they deserved an equal right to the proceeds of their former labor with their former enslavers. Freed people's requests for lands were a demand for reparations, official payments made to recognize and compensate or pay people back for a past wrong. However, the federal government never supported this dream. Instead, the plantation land at Stagville was all kept by the Cameron family. By the end of 1865, as the hope of land distribution faded, some freed people moved away. Others stayed on and signed sharecropping contracts. Sharecropping is an often unfair system in which a landowner allows tenants to live on and use the land, and in return the tenants sign a contract to give the owners a portion of the crops grown. Another priority was family. After emancipation, many people hoped to reunite with loved ones who had been sold or sent away, or simply disappeared. Morgan Latta, formerly enslaved by the Camerons, remembered how people gathered to pray for their family. They woke up at midnight praying out that their prayers might be answered. Wives prayed that they might see their husbands again, and the children prayed that they might see their parents again, and also their brothers and sisters. At least one family tried to return to Stagville after they had been sold away. The Cameron family had sold Elijah and Lucy in 1859. After emancipation, Elijah and his family tried to walk back to find their remaining relatives. When the Camerons learned of this plan, they threatened to guard against Elijah and Lucy returning. Despite this, Elijah and Lucy managed to make it back. After emancipation, many other separated families tried to find each other. Tragically, many never did. For freed people at Stagville, emancipation was the culmination of generations of struggle for liberty. In the first days of freedom, Morgan, Elijah, Lucy, and many others worked to secure their families, homes, and freedom. Long after 1865, their descendants continued their efforts to find full freedom. Here are the captions with the accompanying photographs and drawings. Original 1850s slave dwellings at historic Stagville. A map showing the Cameron Plantation land in blue over modern Durham County. Doc Edwards, who was once a slave enslaved at Stagville. Doc was a young boy when slavery ended. An 1859 plantation record showing Elijah and Lucy's family with a note in the margin saying, "Sold November 59. Stagville is unusual because surviving records include detailed names and family information about enslaved people like this list. The next article is President Johnson Takes Over the Amnesty Process by Alex Christopher Meekins. who is an editor with the North Carolina Historical Research and Publications Office. He is part of the editorial team working on North Carolina Troops, 1861 to 1865, a roster. On December 8, 1863, President Abraham Lincoln outlined his plans for Reconstruction in his annual address to Congress. This included terms for amnesty, which is a general pardon given by a government, especially for political offenses, an official statement that allows people who have been put in prison for crimes against the state to go free. Included terms for amnesty pardon to almost all former Confederates. Amnesty included the requirement that ex-Confederates would have to take an oath of allegiance to the United States. The oath would restore their rights as U.S. citizens, but not the right to enslave people. Lincoln excluded Confederate civil office holders and anyone who mistreated prisoners of war. Lincoln's goal was to heal the nation, but many in Congress felt that his terms were too lenient, too easy, not strict or harsh enough. But on April 14, 1865, President Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. by John Wilkes Booth, who thought he was helping the South somehow. Lincoln was the first president in history to be assassinated. That means murdered by sudden or secret attack, often for political reasons, usually used to describe the killing of a prominent person. He died the next morning on April 15th at 7:22 a.m. At 11 a.m., Vice President Andrew Johnson took the oath of office and became the 17th President of the United States. Here's a sidebar article about Andrew Johnson. Born 1808-1875, the 17th President of the United States. President Andrew Johnson was born in Raleigh into poverty that he was determined to overcome. Apprenticed to a tailor, he ran away and eventually moved to Tennessee. There he married and opened a tailor shop and was taught to read by his wife, Eliza McArdle Johnson. Johnson moved into politics, where he was an advocate of the common man. Elected to the U.S. House of Representatives and U.S. Senate in the 1840s and 1850s, he worked to pass a homestead bill providing free farms for poorer white men. Johnson was nominated by Republicans in the National Union Party for vice president in 1864. His plan of Reconstruction, following President Lincoln's assassination, was put in place while Congress was not in session. The plan was not popular with radical Republicans. Once back in session and with the support of many Northerners, they began work on their own plan of Reconstruction. As president, Johnson took control of the amnesty process. He was a Southerner born in Raleigh. At first, it seemed he would actually be stricter about amnesty than Lincoln had been. But over time, Johnson issued four amnesty proclamations, and each one granted amnesty to more and more people within the formerly rebellious states. In his first proclamation on May 29, 1865, Johnson created 14 groups. Confederates who fell into any one of these categories would not get the general amnesty. However, he offered people in these groups an option to make special application to him for pardon. Johnson promised to review each application and grant clemency, mercy, or compassionate forgiveness, consistent with the facts of the case and the peace and dignity of the United States. President Johnson issued three additional amnesty proclamations. On September 7, 1867, he changed the exemption to include just three groups of individuals: those who held high-ranking Confederate government or military positions, those who mistreated prisoners, and anyone who was directly or indirectly involved in the plot to assassinate Lincoln. Then on July 4, 1868, Johnson issued an amnesty to all Confederates except for about 300 individuals who were under indictment for treason or other felony charges. Treason is the betrayal of one's country, such as helping its enemies during a war or by attempting to overthrow the government. Finally, on Christmas Day, 1868, Johnson extended a full pardon to those individuals, too. Many in Congress were upset by President Johnson's decisions, and these actions led to his impeachment trial. Impeachment is a process by which a government official is charged with misconduct. In the United States, the House of Representatives impeaches or brings charges against an official. This just means there is evidence enough to hold a trial. The Senate then holds a trial and acts as judge. Johnson's special application option generated the records now held in the National Archives and Records Administration in Washington, D.C. More than 2,000 North Carolina residents applied for amnesty. Applications include correspondence, affidavits, a sworn statement in writing, certifications, and other documents. Negative photocopies of the records are in the special collection known as the Military Collection at the State Archives of North Carolina. The files are organized by county and then by last name of the applicant. There is a finding aid that lists the files alphabetically by the last name of the applicant. These records are a great tool to help historians find out more about these North Carolinians and their lives during Reconstruction. There's a photograph of one of these letters, and the caption is, "Andrew Johnson's amnesty proclamation allowed most former Confederates to avoid punishment for their role in the rebellion if they took an oath pledging their loyalty to the United States. People who were excluded from taking this oath had to petition the president for a special pardon. This letter was written by R.L. Abernathy of Burke County." Also earlier in the article, a printing of President Andrew Johnson's May 29, 1865 amnesty proclamation with stricter qualifications from amnesty. Next, some stories from our collection. First is a fireman pike circa 1890 and 1920. Sometimes even the most ordinary-looking artifacts can hold amazing stories. This black iron fireman pike was used by firefighters to pull down burning buildings. How is it connected to Reconstruction? In 1868, John S. Plummer and 11 other newly freed black businessmen in Warrenton saw the urgent need to protect their homes and businesses from fire, so they organized the Plummer Hook and Ladder Fire Company with Plummer as their first fire chief. By 1888, the organization had joined other black fire companies across the state to form the North Carolina Colored Volunteer Firemen's Association. The company later became the Warrenton Volunteer Fire Department. Today, it is known as the oldest African-American fire company in North America. Red shirt uniform, circa 1898. During the 1898 state election campaign, groups of white men wearing red shirts like this one attended political rallies and rode through African-American neighborhoods carrying shotguns. Their goal was to scare black citizens and keep them from voting. Many acts of violence against African-Americans were blamed on the red shirts. Washboard, 1890. This long, narrow washboard was carved from a single block of wood by Willie B. McCoy, an African-American sharecropper from Harnett County. Washboards were used to hand wash clothes before people had Washington machines. First, you would boil water in a big pot over a wood fire. Next, you would soak the clothes in a container of warm, soapy water. To wash, you would put the washboard into the tub feet first, and then you would rub the clothing up and down against the ribs. The friction helped clean them. Finally, a rinse in fresh water, then hang the clothes to dry. Imagine how long it would take to wash all your family's clothes that way. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for blind and print-impaired people. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.